This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. It's now in its fifth edition, I believe. She's also president of the Public Banking Institute. Ellen Brown, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
How did you get on to this subject? You're a lawyer by training, I see, so this is deep into the economic weeds. How'd you find your way in there?
Well, I actually represented some alternative healthcare practitioners that I had written, this is my 11th book, and my first 10 books were on health and the politics of health, which doesn't sound relevant, but as I got deeper into it, I represented a cancer therapist who had been arrested for the alleged crime, or the crime of alleging he had a cancer cure, which he actually did, I thought, but he wound up spending 4.5 years in jail for that. And so in the course of all that, I did a lot of research, and I realized that the drug cartel, which I at then that time thought was the enemy, and the banking cartel were essentially the same thing, that where they got their power was from the power to create money, the Rockefellers and the Morgans. I mean, the medical system that we have today, the drug-based medical system, goes back to the turn of the 20th century, which was Rockefeller and Morgan, and they funded everything through their banks, and that their banks actually created money. In fact, virtually all of our money today is created by banks in the form of loans. So then I realized that if you really wanted to get to the heart of the problem of the control system and why we don't seem to have the freedoms that we think we should have, who's in charge here and where did they get their power, it was from this whole banking, the power to create money.
So you dove in then?
Yeah, so I dove in.
What was that cure for cancer that the person had? I'm just curious.
Well, it was actually very eclectic. He had cancer himself and was supposedly terminal and had been cured. And he started out with the Hoxie treatment, which is he evolved from one treatment to another. So he used a whole range of treatments on his patients, but it was basically the alternative approach. In other words, supporting the body, supporting the immune system rather than destroying the body by attacking it with toxic chemicals and surgery and so forth.
Yeah, I'm always, people have different alternative cures that they are not peddling, but they're experimenting with. So I was just curious about that. William Grider had done a lot of pioneering work on this Federal Reserve System. Did you rely on his book very much?
No, but I have met him, and I was on a panel with him, and I think he does excellent work.
Now, the funny thing about the money supply and the Federal Reserve, it's confusing for people. It's arcane. The way the Federal Reserve used to speak, especially with Alan Greenspan, made it as absolutely indecipherable as possible. It was kind of a world under their own. And you demystify a lot of that in this book, which is one of the beauties of the Web of Debt. Why don't we just start at the beginning? What is the Web of Debt?
Today, this is actually a fact I just learned recently, but 35% of everything we buy goes to interest. These are the statistics of a German researcher, Margaret Kennedy, who most people think if they don't take out a loan or whatever that they aren't paying interest. But in fact, you're paying interest every time you buy something at every level of production. People or producers produce on credit. They have to pay their workers and materials before they have a product to sell, and they have to wait 90 days typically before their end customer pays. So even if they do it on credit cards, that's more than 30 days. So they're going to be paying interest for the production of this product. And if you add all those things together, it comes to 35%. And all those profits go to banks, which then do not feed that money back into the system in the form of they don't pay it back into the system, excuse me. They lend it back into the system for more interest. So it's it goes to rich CEOs who put it in their investments, which are also money-making money. So you have this parasitic growth on the side of the economy that's sucking money out of the economy. So that is the debt, this exponentially growing debt, that nothing in nature grows exponentially except cancer and things that are really destructive to the system. But normal growth goes in an S curve, you know, where you run out, at some point you run out of materials and then, or you level off and become sustainable. So if we want to have a system that is not debt-based and growing exponentially, but is sustainable, this is my argument, you need to have the profits go back to the people.
And you explain at the end of your book some ways to do that. Ellen Brown is my guest today on Progressive Radio. The book is Web of Debt. Before we get to some of those ways, let's start with the Constitution, because I always thought that the Constitution, Article 1, gives Congress the authority to coin money and therefore to regulate the money supply and print dollars and all the things that the private banks are doing, the Federal Reserve is doing. Is that a misinterpretation on my part?
Well, the Constitution says literally Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And coining money is all of the money that Congress creates. All of the rest is created as accounting entries by banks, which when they issue a loan, when you come in for a loan, say you want a loan to buy a house, you will sign a mortgage, which is considered to be a negotiable instrument. It's something that you know, is actually a form of money. So they put that on one side of their balance sheet as an asset to themselves, because you will be paying them back over time with interest. And then they write it as a liability to themselves on the other side of the balance sheet, because you will be paying, they will have to pay whoever you write checks to, they'll have to pay that out, the seller that you bought from. So according to their reasoning, they haven't really created anything. They have merely created a plus one and a minus one, and it all comes out to zero. But that check that goes out into the community and circulates in the money supply, that is our money supply that we use. We don't use much in the way of coins. But we could. The Congress could, if it wanted to, issue 15 $1 trillion coins and pay off the federal debt. They could issue 4 $1 trillion coins and pay their budget every year. And I would argue that it wouldn't actually be inflationary, but that's another issue.
But why, the phrase coin money, though, couldn't you interpret that as meaning, print dollars, too? Why does it have to be literally coining money?
You certainly could, but they don't. That's the thing. They have given away, they've delegated this power when they didn't have to.
And they delegated that early on, and then there was a fight over the banking system with Andrew Jackson, who's kind of a hero in this book. And then they redelegated it again in 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve Board, right?
Yeah. So all through the 19th century, you had banks that actually literally printed their own banknotes and put their name on it. And it was backed by gold. So the theory was that these banknotes were redeemable in gold. So it was really just a receipt for gold. And people, of course, preferred to trade in the paper rather than carrying the gold around. That was the whole idea of having a bank, was that the bank would keep your gold safe for you. But that turned into, they would issue 10 notes for every $1 worth of gold. They could issue $10 worth of notes, because people only came for their gold 10% of the time on average. But it didn't always work that way. And you had your wildcat banks that would issue many times more than $10 per $1 of gold. And so you had crisis after crisis. Like every 6 years on average, there would be a banking crisis. So the first attempt at nationalizing the whole thing was the National Bank Act of 1863, I think, and then there was another in 1865 that made it so you had national banks that would print banknotes that said that it was, it had the national bank name at the top, but they still were the name of the individual banks, and the bank got the money by, they had to put some money on deposit with the Treasury, and then they got these banknotes. And so that was more stable in the sense that a dollar was now worth a dollar, theoretically. But you still had the wildcat banks because there was a state system as well as a federal system. And in order to shut down the state banks, what they did was to tax their banknotes in order to prevent them from issuing their own banknotes. And so to get around that, the banks came up with this whole checking system where they no longer used notes, but they were actually just issuing. They would issue a loan out of a deposit account, which was all just accounting entries. And so then you had this whole another whole system that was very unstable because they would issue many more checks than they would issue more loans than they actually had the gold to back. So in 1913, the Federal Reserve came in to stabilize that, which didn't work so well either because then we had the Great Depression, which was the biggest run on the banks that we ever had. So it's been it's gone like that.
Ellen Brown's my guest here on Progressive Radio. She's the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Talk a little bit more about the Federal Reserve, because it is kind of a misnomer in that it's not federal, it's not public. What is it exactly?
The Federal Reserve is the Federal Reserve Board, you might argue, is federal because it's appointed by the President and Congress, approved by the President. But the Federal Reserve itself consists of 12 Federal Reserve banks, each of which is owned 100% by the banks in its district. So, for example, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is owned by about 500 banks in New York. So the Fed is actually owned by banks, and it serves the banks. And you can tell that just by looking at like the quantitative easing they keep doing. All that money goes into the reserve accounts of banks. They make 0.25% loans from one bank to another, but they don't make that sort of loans to state and local governments. There are many ways that they could get that money into the economy, but they don't do it. They are serving the banks.
And the banks then are doing speculation. And we had this whole terrible crisis starting in 2008 where the whole house of cards collapsed. Were you surprised by that collapse?
Actually, Web of Debt came out in the summer of 2007, and I was predicting that. And in fact, I thought it would happen before that. You know, I was always trying to improve my prose and get my little Wizard of Oz quotes in there and so forth. And I was, no, don't collapse yet. But then in the summer of 2007, that was when the two Bear Stearns hedge funds collapsed. And they had to sell their assets, which meant they had to open their books and show all these CDOs collateralized debt obligations, and there was no market for them. Nobody would buy them because they knew that they were had toxic mortgages in them. And so if their collateralized debt obligations were worth nothing, nobody's were worth anything. So there was a whole sort of global panic then, and then they corrected it. I mean, the market went down and the market went back up, and they sort of stabilized it for a while, but then the whole thing really collapsed in 2008.
So you got your book out just in time, actually.
Yeah, I rushed it out as soon as I...
Yeah, you can hold on to books too long, that's for sure. Then we had this bailout by Paulson and by the Federal Reserve Board under Bush and then again under Obama. How do you assess that bailout?
It served the banks. It was designed to serve the banks. The thing that people get really upset about is the fact that the Federal Reserve generated, depending on who you read, it's like $18 trillion or $23 trillion in short-term loans to bail out the banks. Those weren't actually payouts. They were just loans.
Guarantees, too.
Yeah, and they could have done that for the – it's really the local – governments that are suffering from all this, and then we're all suffering in turn, plus the homeowners, but it would be harder to bail out the homeowners. But you could certainly have bailed out the state and local governments in the same way that they bailed out the banks, and we would be in much better shape today. And in other words, that bailout money did not make it into the real economy.
And with that money, you know, we could own the banks, a couple of those. We could own Citibank and Bank of America for all the money that we were giving them or guaranteeing to them. There was some talk of nationalizing the bank, and not just from the Progressive magazine and me, Matt Rothschild, but from, you know, some very starchy conservative economists and bankers. And I think even Alan Greenspan at one point said that we'd have to consider nationalizing, so bad was the crisis. But that passed. Why wasn't, I mean, that went by. That moment went by. How come there wasn't a bigger move to nationalize these banks that had gotten themselves into this trouble and were taking the whole economy and the world economy down with them?
Mm-hmm. Well, nationalized sounds like something that's un-American, but that is actually what you're supposed to do with a bankrupt bank. The FDIC is supposed to go in, impose a receivership, and if it's a small bank, they just sell off the assets and the bank goes out of business. If it's a little larger, then they take it over by one of the other banks. But if it's a really big bank, you're supposed to actually nationalize it. And that's happened before with, like, Continental Illinois. That was the biggest example in the U.S. In 1994, it was nationalized for a number of years. So the fact that they bailed them out is what was radical. That was what was different. It had never been done before. But because the banks own Congress, and that there was actually literally that complaint, you know, by, was it Alan Grayson? Or
no, it was by Dick Durbin, Senator of Illinois.
Oh, right. Dick Durbin said the banks own Congress. So there was just, Henry Paulson fell on his knees and apparently in front of and said that, you know, the whole global economy would collapse if we didn't bail out.
I mean, it was very dramatic. The threats were catastrophic. One California congressman said that he was told that the government would have to implement martial law if we didn't bail out the banks. Right. And actually the first attempt to get Congress to pass it failed, and then the hysteria got ramped up more. And the banks didn't have to do anything except say, yes, we'll take all this money, mm-hmm. except open their palms, really. And that's, I think, one of the tragedies of this big bailout, in that they weren't forced either by Bush and Paulson or by Obama and Geithner to give something back, to either say we're not going to foreclose upon people, even though we gave them these a lot of these mortgages that were deceptive, or reduce principal on the mortgages, on the 60 million mortgages that are floating around out there because the housing market was so inflated anyway. They had the power, which is to say the president had the power when they were offering all this money to the banks, but that didn't happen either. Why not?
Well, because the banks are in control. I think it's the same reason that the president doesn't make any headway. There's always a pushback. In the 1930s, Roosevelt was able to do all those things. He disciplined the banks. He had the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which funded everything in sight, and nobody objected. They just plowed ahead and did it. So they had an administration that could actually forge ahead. Well, of course, Henry Paulson is part of the Treasury is part of the administration. So the administration has been infiltrated by the bankers.
Well, it's been common to have the Treasury Secretary be a Wall Street person.
Right, be a Goldman Sachs person. Yeah.
So that's kind of crazy, too, and very indicative of where the power's lying. Politically, before we get into specific ideas, I mean, how do we change things given the fact that the banks own the place and we have the Citizens United decision that allows corporations and banks to dip directly into their vaults and spend millions and millions of dollars to elect this candidate or trash the other candidate? So politically, do you see there being some room to dethrone the money powers?
Well, you can't. I don't see it at the federal level. I think it is locked up, and that's why I'm head of the Public Banking Institute. And what our idea is to start at the local level. That you could have What we need to do is set up a better mousetrap and just move into it rather than trying to fight the existing system. Just set up our own and gradually they won't be too big to fail if we don't need them anymore, if we have another system. So the system would be a public banking system where the profits go back to the public, which is actually a mathematically sustainable system. We only have one such bank right now. That's the Bank of North Dakota. It's been publicly owned since 1919. North Dakota is the only state that escaped the credit crisis. It has the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate on loans, and it's doing very well generally. So the Bank of North Dakota supports the local banks, helps them with their capital requirements, kept them out of the subprime crisis because they didn't need to sell off to investors, et cetera.
Ellen Brown is the author of Web of Debt. She's my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Are other states considering forming their own state banks?
Right now we have 20 states that have actually introduced legislation in one form or another. Nobody's actually passed it yet. But it's a process of education because it's a difficult thing to sell because we've been sort of brainwashed from birth into this other form of banking. And so to grasp the idea is, the first thing you have to understand is why it's a better idea.
Ellen Brown is also the president of the Public Banking Institute. When was that formed and what does it do exactly?
I was formed nearly 2 years ago, and we're just an educational organization promoting the idea of spreading information on public banks around the world, how well the system works, and how you could set up a bank in your own state or city or county. There are things you could do at the county level that are quite exciting with this whole over half the mortgages in the country are owned by MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, which is an electronic database. So courts are increasingly holding that MERS cannot hold title. It's just a smokescreen. And if it doesn't hold title, nobody holds title. So you could take over those properties by eminent domain through a county land bank and use that as your, if you doubled that with a bank on this Bank of North Dakota model, you could generate credit for your whole county and get things turned around.
And this is also, I mean, you're a lawyer by training, advice for attorneys and for homeowners facing foreclosure, that you need to, before you leave your house, make them come up with the actual documents, right? You shouldn't let a bank or a court foreclose upon you if they can't really find who owns the actual paper that says who owns that house.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on if you're in a judicial or a non-judicial state. California is a non-judicial state, which means that they can just go in and foreclose without going to court. So if you, the homeowner, have to try to drag them into court, you need to pay attorney's fees, and it's daunting. People don't understand it. They're afraid they're going to lose any leverage they have with their bank. So that's why it's a better idea if you have as somebody who's fighting on your side, which a county land bank could do. They could take these properties over and then do the fair thing for the homeowner and for the investors and for all parties.
Are there county land banks that are doing that right now?
There are county land banks, but they don't do that. And there are several counties that are looking at taking properties by eminent domain. And so you could combine those two ideas and...
You've got other ideas in this book, Web of Debt, Ellen Brown, that are quite interesting. One of those is this thing called community currency, and we've had some examples of that in Madison. But the one of those in your book that you talk about is Ithaca, New York, Ithaca Hours. Explain what that's all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just a currency that it's... In the Constitution, states cannot issue their own currencies, but there's no law that says that a community can't issue a currency. The hours currency was just based on the idea that 1 hour is 1 hour of your work is worth an hour of somebody else's work, and you would just that it's just a paper currency, and you could trade work. So the members themselves are actually generating this credit or this money just by taking out credits and using them in trade. So it's a basic sort of a an improvement on a barter system, but it increases the money supply, which we desperately need right now, is real money in the real economy, not siphoned off into these capital accounts that are on the side of the economy taking money out of it.
Where do credit unions fit into this whole picture?
Credit unions are a good idea if you want to move your money. They're obviously better than a big Wall Street bank. But the problem is that they're privately owned and they're very vulnerable to all small banks are vulnerable right now. That Wall Street has just pretty much taken over.
Vulnerable to being bought up?
That because they're vulnerable to going bankrupt, which means they, you know, they don't have the capital base to support a lot of risky loans. And so you can do a lot more with a publicly owned bank, which would have the state revenues or the county revenues to back it.
And then going back to the national picture, what should be done with the Federal Reserve Board or the Federal Reserve Board system?
Ideally, I think they should be literally nationalized. In other words, they should rewrite the Federal Reserve Act. Congress wrote it in the first place. They could write it again and put in there that if they're going to do something like quantitative easing, it should be to serve the people and not just the banks. They wrote the legislation in the first place. They could rewrite it in a way that served the people.
I didn't realize until I read this, though I may have read it in William Grider's book too and forgotten it because I'm getting older now, that in 1913 it was written and passed right before Christmas and legislators were ready to go home and no one really knew what they were voting on. And then Woodrow Wilson later on, who had signed it, said it was the biggest regret of his life and there goes the country or something like that, right?
Yeah. I've read it. And it's still very obscure. It's hard to tell what they're talking about. And the people who signed it, it was William Jennings Bryan who led the opposition, and he said no way would he sign a bill where the banks, where Wall Street would be issuing the money and charging interest on it. And that's actually what they got. But he didn't, in the end, he supported it, and he said they changed the name, you know, to the Federal Reserve Act, and he said he celebrated because at last the government would be issuing the money, but it wasn't. Even the people who were the most critical didn't understand it.
You showed William Jennings Bryan in his glory days in the late 1890s there, and it was refreshing again to read what a real populist he was. I think a lot of people have him all confused in their minds with the Scopes trial and being backwards that way, but he was a real fighter for people and for control over the money power. That's one of the themes of this book, Web of Debt, that Alan Brown, my guest today, talks about taking back the money power. We have less than a minute left here, and I'm just wondering what you would suggest to someone who's listening to this program in her car, in his kitchen, or in the office. What's the first thing they could do to take back the money power?
Well, I think we need local publicly owned banks, and you can get organized to do that. Either you have to persuade a legislator to bring a bill, or you can bring an initiative. But if you bring an initiative, then you have to persuade the people, which means they have to understand what you're talking about. So the first thing is to just spread information, and we have a lot of information on our website, publicbankinginstitute.org, and I have like over 150 articles on my website, webofdebt.com.
Well, Ellen Brown, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. It's been a pleasure meeting you and reading your book.
And thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.